I want to set down some general remarks about tramps. When one comes to think of it, tramps are a queer product and worth thinking over. It is queer that a tribe of men, tens of thousands in number, should be marching up and down England like so many wandering Jews. But though the case obviously wants considering, one cannot even start to consider it until one has got rid of certain prejudices. These prejudices are rooted in the idea that every tramp, ipso facto, is a blackguard. In childhood, we have been taught that tramps are blackguards, and consequently there exists in our minds a sort of ideal or typical tramp, a repulsive, rather dangerous creature who would die rather than work or wash, and wants nothing but to beg, drink, and rob hen houses. This tramp monster is no truer to life than the sinister Chinaman of the magazine stories. But he is very hard to get rid of. The very word tramp evokes his image, and the belief in him obscures the real questions of vagrancy. To take a fundamental question about vagrancy, why do tramps exist at all? It is a curious thing, but very few people know what makes a tramp take to the road. And because of the belief in the tramp monster, the most fantastic reasons are suggested. It is said, for instance, that tramps tramp to avoid work, to beg more easily, to seek opportunities for crime, even, least probable of reasons, because they like tramping. I have even read in a book of criminology that the tramp is an atavism, a throwback to the nomadic stage of humanity. And meanwhile, the quite obvious cause of vagrancy is staring one in the face. Of course a tramp is not a nomadic atavism. One might as well say that a commercial traveller is an atavism. A tramp tramps not because he likes it, but for the same reason as a car keeps to the left, because there happens to be a law compelling him to do so. A destitute man, if he is not supported by the parish, can only get relief at the casual wards, and as each casual ward will only admit him for one night, he is automatically kept moving. He is a vagrant because, in the state of the law, it is that or starve. But people have been brought up to believe in the tramp monster, and so they prefer to think that there must be some more or less villainous motive for tramping. As a matter of fact, very little of the tramp monster will survive inquiry. Take the generally accepted idea that tramps are dangerous characters. Quite apart from experience, one can say a priori that very few tramps are dangerous because if they were dangerous, they would be treated accordingly. A casual ward will often admit 100 tramps in one night, and these are handled by a staff of at most 3 porters. 100 ruffians could not be controlled by 3 unarmed men. Indeed, when one sees how tramps let themselves be bullied by the workhouse officials, it is obvious that they are the most docile, broken-spirited creatures imaginable. Or take the idea that all tramps are drunkards, an idea ridiculous on the face of it. No doubt many tramps would drink if they got the chance, but in the nature of things they cannot get the chance. At this moment a pale, watery stuff called beer is 7 pence a pint in England. To be drunk on it would cost at least 0.5 crown, and a man who can command 0.5 crown at all often is not a tramp. The idea that tramps are impudent social parasites, sturdy beggars, is not absolutely unfounded. But it is only true in a few percent of the cases. Deliberate cynical parasitism, such as one reads of in Jack London's books on American tramping, is not in the English character. The English are a conscience-ridden race, with a strong sense of the sinfulness of poverty. One cannot imagine the average Englishman deliberately turning parasite, and this national character does not necessarily change because a man is thrown out of work. Indeed, if one remembers that a tramp is only an Englishman out of work, forced by law to live as a vagabond, then the tramp monster vanishes. I'm not saying, of course, that most tramps are ideal characters. I am only saying that they are ordinary human beings, and that if they are worse than other people, it is the result and not the cause of their way of life. It follows that the serve and damned well right attitude that is normally taken towards tramps is no fairer than it would be towards cripples or invalids. When one has realized that, one begins to put oneself in a tramp's place and understand what his life is like. It is an extraordinarily futile, acutely unpleasant life. I have described the casual ward, the routine of a tramp's day, but there are three especial evils that need insisting upon. The first is hunger, which is the almost general fate of tramps. The casual ward gives them a ration which is probably not even meant to be sufficient, and anything beyond this must be got by begging, that is, by breaking the law. The result is that nearly every tramp is rotted by malnutrition, for proof of which one need only look at the men lining up outside any casual ward. The second great evil of a tramp's life, it seems much smaller at first sight, but it is a good second, is that he is entirely cut off from contact with women. This point needs elaborating. Tramps are cut off from women in the first place because there are very few women at their level of society. One might imagine that among destitute people the sexes would be as equally balanced as elsewhere, but it is not so. In fact, one can almost say that below a certain level, society is entirely male. The following figures, published by the LCC from a night census taken on February the 13th, 1931, will show the relative numbers of destitute men and destitute women. Spending the night in the streets, 60 men, 18 women. In shelters and homes not licensed as common lodging houses, 1,057 men, 137 women. In the crypt of St. Martin's in the Fields Church, 88 men, 12 women. In LCC casual wards and hostels, 674 men, 15 women. It will be seen from these figures that at the charity level, men outnumber women by something like 10 to 1. The cause is presumably that unemployment affects women less than men. Also, that any presentable woman can, in the last resort, attach herself to some man. The result for a tramp is that he is condemned to perpetual celibacy. For of course it goes without saying that if a tramp finds no women at his own level, those above, even a very little above, are as far out of his reach as the moon. The reasons are not worth discussing, but there is no doubt that women never, or hardly ever, condescend to men who are much poorer than themselves. A tramp, therefore, is a celibate from the moment when he takes to the road. He is absolutely without hope of getting a wife, a mistress, or any kind of woman except, very rarely, when he can raise a few shillings, a prostitute. It is obvious what the results of this must be. Homosexuality, for instance, and occasional rape cases. But deeper than these, there is the degradation worked in a man who knows that he is not even considered fit for marriage. The sexual impulse, not to put it any higher, is a fundamental impulse, and starvation of it can be almost as demoralizing as physical hunger. The evil of poverty is not so much that it makes a man suffer as that it rots him physically and spiritually, and there can be no doubt that sexual starvation contributes to this rotting process. Cut off from the whole race of women, a tramp feels himself degraded to the rank of a cripple or a lunatic. No humiliation could do more damage to a man's self-respect. The other great evil of a tramp's life is enforced idleness. By our vagrancy laws, things are so arranged that when he is not walking the road, he is sitting in a cell, or in the intervals, lying on the ground waiting for the casual ward to open. It is obvious that this is a dismal, demoralizing way of life, especially for an uneducated man. Besides these, one could enumerate scores of minor evils, to name only one: discomfort, which is inseparable from life on the road. It is worth remembering that the average tramp has no clothes but what he stands up in, wears boots that are ill-fitting, and does not sit in a chair for months together. But the important point is that a tramp's sufferings are entirely useless. He lives a fantastically disagreeable life and lives it to no purpose whatever. One could not, in fact, invent a more futile routine than walking from prison to prison, spending perhaps 18 hours a day in the cell and on the road. There must be, at the least, several tens of thousands of tramps in England. Each day they expend innumerable foot-pounds of energy, enough to plough thousands of acres, build miles of road, put up dozens of houses in mere useless walking. Each day they waste between them possibly 10 years of time in staring at cell walls. They cost the country at least £1 a week a man, and give nothing in return for it. They go round and round on an endless, boring game of general post, which is of no use and is not even meant to be of any use to any person whatever. The law keeps this process going, and we have got so accustomed to it that we are not surprised. But it is very silly. Granting the futility of a tramp's life, the question is whether anything could be done to improve it. Obviously, it would be possible, for instance, to make the casual wards a little more habitable, and this is actually being done in some cases. During the last year, some of the casual wards have been improved beyond recognition, if the accounts are true, and there is talk of doing the same to all of them. But this does not go to the heart of the problem. The problem is how to turn the tramp from a bored, half-alive vagrant into a self-respecting human being. A mere increase of comfort cannot do this. Even if the casual wards became positively luxurious, they never will, a tramp's life would still be wasted. He would still be a pauper, cut off from marriage and home life, and a dead loss to the community. What is needed is to depauperize him, and this can only be done by finding him work. Not work for the sake of working, but work of which he can enjoy the benefit. At present, in the great majority of casual wards, tramps do no work whatever. At one time they were made to break stones for their food, but this was stopped when they had broken enough stone for years ahead and put the stone breakers out of work. Nowadays they are kept idle because there is seemingly nothing for them to do. Yet there is a fairly obvious way of making them useful, namely this. Each workhouse could run a small farm, or at least a kitchen garden, and every able-bodied tramp who presented himself could be made to do a sound day's work. The produce of the farm or garden could be used for feeding the tramps, and at the worst it would be better than the filthy diet of bread and margarine and tea. Of course, the casual wards could never be quite self-supporting, but they could go a long way towards it, and the rates would probably benefit in the long run. It must be remembered that under the present system, tramps are as dead a loss to the country as they could possibly be, for they not only do no work, but they live on a diet that is bound to undermine their health. The system, therefore, loses lives as well as money. A scheme which fed them decently and made them produce at least a part of their own food, would be worth trying. It may be objected that a farm or even a garden could not be run with casual labour, but there is no real reason why tramps should only stay a day at each casual ward. They might stay a month or even a year if there were work for them to do. The constant circulation of tramps is something quite artificial. At present, a tramp is an expense to the rates, and the object of each workhouse is therefore to push him on to the next, hence the rule that he can stay only one night. If he returns within a month, he is penalized by being confined for a week, and as this is much the same as being in prison, naturally he keeps moving. But if he represented labor to the workhouse, and the workhouse represented sound food to him, it would be another matter. The workhouses would develop into partially self-supporting institutions, and the tramps, settling down here or there according as they were needed, would cease to be tramps. They would be doing something comparatively useful, getting decent food and living a settled life. By degrees, if the scheme worked well, they might even cease to be regarded as paupers and be able to marry and take a respectable place in society. This is only a rough idea, and there are some obvious objections to it. Nevertheless, it does suggest a way of improving the status of tramps without piling new burdens on the rates, and the solution must, in any case, be something of this kind. For the question is, what to do with men who are underfed and idle? And the answer, to make them grow their own food, imposes itself automatically.